This episode is brought to you by BundleRabbit.com, Earth's most accessible book bundling marketplace.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer. I'm the author of some 27 books, 34 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this journey to raise your productivity to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, episode 534.
Today, Robert asks,
"Help! I think I've committed poetry. Seriously, I'm not usually into poetry, though I can appreciate many I've encountered. Yet, somehow I had an idea to incorporate the cliché of a fantasy prophecy by turning it into a work song, a shanty. I've borrowed the rhythm from an old one from when sailing ships brought trade between Australia and the UK. Elsewhere, I've supported the practice in the made-up culture by creating a few lines for other work songs interspersed with description action. I have a character sing the important prophecy piece, though the characters do not know that it is what it is. This leaves me with a few questions on how to manage this. Firstly, there is a chorus. Will repeating the chorus after each verse take up too much page space? Is this bashing the reader with too much poetry? I do incorporate some description between verses. Will description help the mood, or will it break the flow of a reader's attention? Is there a standard way to format songs, poetry within a novel? Any tips on how to do this? What does one have to watch out for when including songs and poetry in narrative? If one isn't used to writing poetry, how can we tell if it is on the nose?"
Well, I'm going to work backwards here. I assume by on the nose you mean appropriate rather than what you normally mean with that by writing, which is too explicit and kind of insulting to the reader's intelligence. Assuming that you mean on the nose being a good thing rather than a bad thing, that you mean that it's appropriate rather than that it's redundant and over explicit. You can tell if it's appropriate because it accomplishes what you want to accomplish in the story. You've done the right job. Formatting, you can do anything. I mean, it's your book, but if you're looking for how it's traditionally handled, like in an epic fantasy book, usually the poetry, it always has a meter and a rhyme scheme because it's meant to be remembered and sung. So you're gonna have it laid out with a solid left line set in toward the middle of the page, so like the block of poetry is centered, but the poetry itself is ragged right, solid left. A good model to look at for all of these questions that you're talking about, and I know I'm going to make some people who are listening turn over in their graves right now, or their couches, or their running shoes, or whatever they're occupying while they're listening to this. A good model to look at is J.R.R. Tolkien in The Hobbit, The Dwarf's Song, because that answers all your questions. He does it exactly right in terms of it conforming well to the ancient bardic poetry type that you're talking about. So, for example, whether to intersperse narration or not. Well, Tolkien does not intersperse narration in that instance because that song is a story in its own right, kind of like the poem you sent along is a story in its own right. And he wants the reader to be absorbed in the song. The song has a hypnotic effect on Bilbo. He wants the song to have a hypnotic effect on the reader. And indeed, if you read it aloud, it really does have that kind of effect. "The dwarves of yore made mighty spell, where hammers fell like ringing bells, in places deep where dark things sleep, in hollow halls beneath the fells. On silver necklaces they strung the flowering stars, on crowns they hung the dragon fire in twisted wire, they meshed the light of moon and sun." You read that out loud to a kid, and the kid is going to be utterly enraptured. Now, as an adult reading it over quietly, it's not going to have that same effect on you, but bardic poetry is not meant to be read silently. And Tolkien knew very well what he was going for. Now, that poem also has a chorus in it. And the way he keeps the chorus interesting, and this is a very good technique to employ, especially if you're talking about poetic prophecy and that sort of thing, is that the chorus iterates every time. There is a refrain Far over misty mountains cold, through dungeons deep and caverns old, we must away your break of day. But then the end of every chorus is different. It reflects the transition from one verse to the next. So it starts off, to seek our pale enchanted gold, to find our long forgotten gold. And at the end, after seven verses, where they've been talking about the dragon stealing their hall and stealing their gold and hoarding everything and killing everyone and driving them from their homeland, the final line of the final refrain is to win our harps of gold from him as the revenge. And actually, now that I think about it, the second and fourth line actually iterate to alter the rhyme scheme. So, through dungeons deep and caverns old rhymes with to seek our pale enchanted gold, and at the very end, it's through dungeons deep and caverns dim to win our harps of gold from him. And so, by doing that, it keeps the chorus interesting, it makes it a vital part of the flow of the narration, and it uses every opportunity to evolve the story and to spin the yarn. And that's a really good trick for using poetry in narrative, because you're not singing it, and thus providing a musical ground point where you're resting between verses. What you can do instead, because it's not being sung, is to keep it linguistically interesting so people don't just look at it and say, ah, well, it's the same thing, I'll skip over. You want them to stick in the poem, so you make every chorus a little bit different. It's a really good old bardic tradition that Tolkien resurrected with The Hobbit, and that Filkers have been making really good use of ever since. So that may be a way to do it. So the other two questions you've asked me here are, is it going to bash the reader over the head with too much poetry, and what do you need to think of when including songs and poetry in narrative? And the two questions are kind of related. The way that you handle the poetry in the songs will justify their inclusion. That said, you are going to turn off some readers. Reading poetry is not a normal pastime anymore. It used to be a integral part of everyday life 500-600 years ago. And since the invention of the printing press, it has been slowly getting less and less mindshare. So it's now kind of a rarefied genre. It is only in a world where poetry is not popular in any form other than song lyrics, that you can get some of the ridiculous stuff that gets published in modern poetry journals, where it's not actually poetry, it's just rhetoric that's got interesting spacing in it. Slam poetry is the same thing. Slam poetry is a rhetorical art form. It's not poetry. It's a rhetorical art that's got a lot more in common with homiletics than it does with poetry. But because it sort of evolved, the culture around it evolved out of the beat poetry scene, it's maintained the word poetry even though it's got nothing to do with poetry by any definition of the word. So including it in the book at all is going to polarize your audience. You're going to really enchant some people if you do it well, and just the mere presence of it done well or poorly is just going to turn some readers off and they're going to skip it. So one of the things you might want to think of is how to make it clear to the readers, either beforehand or in retrospect, that if they don't read this, they're going to miss a key component of the book. There's a whole bunch of ways that you can do that, by having the characters refer back to it without quoting it, by building it up so that you make it clear that you're nesting a big reveal inside the poem or that sort of thing. Something that gives it a sense of occasion would not go amiss. As far as bashing your readers over the head with too much poetry, well, the ones that go along with you on the poetic journey will tolerate an amazing amount of poetry if you tell your story well and you do your poem well, as evidenced by all the people who still read Tolkien and don't skip the poems. Anytime you get in a conversation about Tolkien with fantasy fans, you will have two camps. You will have the, oh my god, the songs and the poetry give such depth and resonance to the world, and then you'll have the people who say, oh, I like the stories, but why does he have to include so much poetry? And you're just going to have that split. So what you want to do
and
is...
And sometimes they marry each other.
Not that we know anything about that. So if you're going to split your audience like that, you want to make sure to service the poetry fans well. And then tell your story well enough, as well as you can, so that you will reward the poetry haters and keep them in the story, even though they hate you for including the poems.
Since he is asking about prophecy and beating people over the head with prophecy, I think by on the nose, He might possibly be meaning, how can I tell if the prophecy is too obvious to my readers?
Oh, okay, okay. So, thank you. There was a wonderful line in Babylon 5 where Delenn says at one point, prophecy is a poor guide to the future because it's recognizable only in hindsight. You can only tell if it's been fulfilled after the fact. And most good prophecy is like this. I mean, what was it? Penn Jillette called Nostradamus a bad poet with a paranoid streak. And he's actually, that's a fair description. But Nostradamus has followers even today because his writing was so cryptic that you can sort of read anything into it. And the way that prophecy evolved as a genre, particularly as it comes down to us from the Levant and from Western Europe, it's a highly symbolic genre that is meant to be both immediately relevant and infinitely relevant. One of the reasons is that frequently people who write prophecies are writing thinly veiled political manifestos, like, for example, the Book of Revelation, and they want their intended audience to understand what they're talking about, and they don't want the authorities who might lock them up for being treasonous and seditious to understand what they're talking about for fear that they would get locked up or executed. So the trick with prophecy from the prophet's point of view is to couch the prophecy in enough symbolic and ambiguous language that the intended audience will understand it right away, and the unintended audience will look at it and go, what the hell's this deal with this dragon with seven heads? I don't get it. Or they'll look at it and go, oh, a seven-headed dragon. That must mean that there's going to be a planet that comes by and wipes out all life on Earth. Which is why you still get people reading the Book of Revelation today thinking it must still be relevant because the world hasn't ended yet, when it is quite clearly written to Christians during the persecutions under Nero after the fire of Rome, or written as if it was written during that time but for Christians under Domitian, which is a whole other biblical studies rabbit trail I won't bore you with. But whatever the case, it is definitely meant to be understood as having been written during the reign of Nero. And there's clues to that all over the place. If you know a little bit about Hebrew numerology and a little bit about Roman history, it's not very hard to figure out. But the Roman authorities who might have seized copies of this thing would have read it and gone, what the hell are they talking about? This is mystery cult bullshit. Ah, don't throw them away. These guys are just bad writers. You know, get them out on the street where they can busk. And, you know, that's what it was supposed to do. But prophecy is intended to be simultaneously specific and ambiguous. And so what you want is something that at the end of the book, your audience can look back and go, oh yeah, definitely that was the prophecy. But that the characters in the book and the audience going along are going to misinterpret because they don't have all the pieces to put it together. In my opinion, and it is an opinion, that's how you tell if your prophecy is too on the nose or not. There's a whole bunch of other ways to approach it that have been successful with writers, including that there is one character who knows exactly what it means for reasons, supernatural reasons, or because they're in on the secret knowledge or what have you, or prophecies that are obvious on the face of them, and that creates problems for the main character, i.e., for example, Harry Potter. That was a very specific prophecy that could have been more ambiguous if Neville had turned out to be the prophesied Messiah, and that was a big missed opportunity, I thought. But there are writers that have made different prophetic paradigms work. So what I've just given you is my opinion, which is based on an appreciation of prophecy as a historical genre. And it's not necessarily the only way things will work in a fantasy novel. So if my opinion is useful to you, feel free to take it as a starting point, but please don't consider it the last word. Thank you very much for sending in the question, Robert. This is the kind of question I never thought we'd get, and it's loads of fun. I'll see you all tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2018 by J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2018 Artistic Whispers Productions. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners.